the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Patricia Highsmith, the author of the classic crime novels Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley and dozens more, was as grim and dark a personality as the characters in her book. Highsmith died some 15 years ago, but she lives again, for better or for worse, in a new book by author and dramatist Joan Shenkar. The book is called The Talented Miss Highsmith, and the author is my guest this week. Joan Shenkar, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, I'm delighted to be speaking with you.
This book, it's a mammoth undertaking. It's huge. It's 700 pages or something.
My Moby Dick, I think we'll have to call it.
Did you know when you were getting involved that it was going to be this huge thing?
If I knew what I was getting into before I'd gotten involved in it, I probably wouldn't have done it. Happily, I did not, and it's turned out to be perhaps the most rewarding book of my entire career.
You spent, what, 7 years? Is that what it's
like? Oh, 8 years.
Uh-huh.
Let's call it eight,
okay.
To be honest. And a lot of that time was thinking,
yeah.
As well as researching all over the world, since Highsmith was, as her mother said, born restless and incredibly peripatetic. She had the largest archives of any writer who died in the 20th century. If you measured them linearly, and that's a Swiss specialty, and since her archives were in Switzerland, they would be 150 feet long. I had to read every page in that 150 feet.
And it feels like she never had a thought that she didn't commit to paper in some form.
Well, she did have, as well as all her other interesting traits, she was hypergraphic. She wrote all the time, but that did not prevent her from leading quite an extraordinary life, a life that no one has ever penetrated before, because they made the initial mistake of taking Patricia Highsmith at her word. She always said she lived a very dull life, pretended to be the most reclusive writer in the last part of the 20th century. In fact, she was the most social recluse in the world. And so once you begin to trace her patterns and to walk in her shoes, which I did, I'm a big believer in ambulomancy, which is divination by walking, you begin to find the psychological patterns that created this really extraordinary writer.
Well, she's such a disturbing person. Did it get to you? Was it disturbing to walk
in her shoes? I was out of my mind every day, no doubt about it. Her specialty is to reverse every idea you ever had of being human and to turn upside down most of the conclusions we have come to as humanists. I've never thought of myself as a humanist, but compared to Miss Highsmith, I am Mother Teresa.
Well,
no doubt about it.
We see children playing and we think how sweet, and she sees children playing and makes a list of ways they could kill their parents.
That's right. She never strayed far from her serious artistic motives, which were buried in her childhood. She was a real Freudian, avant la lettre. She read some Freud, but not seriously. She was a natural Freudian. She believed that what she was and who she was had been created by the age of six. And to a very real extent, it had been. By the age of 12, she said she was thinking of herself as a boy in a girl's body. That was not inaccurate. And so she had an experience like the character in Greek drama Tiresias, who had been both a man and a woman. She could actually write from both positions, though she generally chose to write in the voice of a man. And by the way, there's just one correction I wanted to make in your excellent introduction. I don't think of Highsmith as a crime novelist. If anything, she's a punishment novelist. The crime is not the point of what she does. You always know who commits the crime. It's the effect the murders that are committed in her books have upon their perpetrators that are so important.
She's generally with the criminal in the
book. Yes. Yes, and it's so refreshing, really. When she set out to write The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is probably the novel of hers which is best known in the United States through, naturally, films.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Minghella's film of Ripley with Matt Damon and that English actor whose name I always forget.
I always forget Jude Law's name, too.
That's
I can't remember
what it is. And I've even seen him on the stage without his clothes on, and I still forget it.
Well, no wonder.
Probably because I didn't like the film very well. It, although it was a lovely film, it...
Well, when we love books, it's always difficult to appreciate film versions of them.
Well, love is an interesting word to use in relationship to Highsmith's work. It's, and of course, we're making her out to be much more, much darker than she is. In fact, she had a life full of incidents and fascinating sexual connections and was in the middle of everything in mid-20th century New York. But when she set out to write Ripley, she really thought of, she said that she was going to create a character whose criminality would force his readers to root for him, and that's exactly what you do. That book is the most successful critique of capitalism I've ever seen, because Ripley, like Patricia Highsmith, like most Americans, was a firm believer in the American dream. If you work hard enough, you will attain your goal. His work just happened to be murder, exchange of identities, stealing someone's trust fund, killing again, and every time he does it, he gets better looking, he gets richer, he is rewarded. So it's a very interesting look at the ethics of capitalism turned upside down.
Well, we're talking with Joan Shankar, and her book is called The Talented Miss Highsmith, a biography of Patricia Highsmith. Now, let's talk a little bit more about her. I was really pleased and surprised to learn, since I'm a big comic book fan, that she wrote a lot of comic books back in the golden age of comics.
Oh, indeed she did, and this is something no one knew. Highsmith always said, and this again is, you must never take a writer at her word. We writers all have bad characters, and especially when we're being interviewed, tend to, now I don't want to discredit what I'm going to say, so I better stop this sentence right now, but let's just say that interviews are not necessarily the best way to get at the truth of a writer's life. And so in interviews, Highsmith would say that she'd worked for a few months for the comics, for a couple of comics, when she got out of Barnard College in 1942. She had a 7-year-long secret career writing for superheroes in the golden age of American comics. Her career was so rich and so long and intersected with so many people, including Stan Lee. Will Eisner had something to say about her. I got to interview all these great people. Her career was so long and so significant in what is one of our only one of two great American arts. We have only two Native American arts in the United States. One is jazz, the other is the comic book. Highsmith was the only woman scriptwriter for comics during the Golden Age.
And were you able to uncover her actual comics that she wrote?
I was. I name them all. Because scriptwriters, and very often inkers, pencilers, and drawers, too, weren't allowed to sign their comics, I can't point to specific stories except in a couple of cases where she's noted it in her diary, but I certainly was able to trace the years that she worked. I was able to trace the superheroes she wrote for and the times that she wrote for them. So I can make very good guesses as to which comics she worked on.
And I guess the idea of a superhero with a secret identity fits into the Patricia Highsmith.
Well, exactly. Canon. This is what people never understood about Highsmith, and this is what makes her so quintessentially American. For years and years, people, scholars have always pointed her greatest influence as Dostoevsky, with his idea of the alter ego, the criminal exalting himself. Oh no, it wasn't Dostoevsky. It wasn't Kafka. It was Superman and Batman. It was, you know, the superhero with a mild-mannered... If you think of Tom Ripley, a mild-mannered young grifter who essentially falls in love with this rich young man he is sent to bring back from Europe, they become alter egos of each other. And Ripley, after he kills this young man, assumes his identity, just like Clark Kent disappears into Superman. And because Ripley is able to suppress his own identity and become this projected superhero, he gets better and better, more accomplished. By the end of the Ripley series, he's playing the harpsichord. He's set up in a beautiful Maison du Maître in Paris, in France, and he's, you know, beautifully accoutred. So a lot of that comes from the comics.
Her roots in comic books.
Yeah, Highsmith never acknowledged this. And what's more, she destroyed every bit of comic book work she ever did.
She was embarrassed, ashamed, or what?
Yes, everyone who worked for the comics was embarrassed and ashamed of it. They had all wanted better, so-called better careers. Most of the comic book, most of our great comic book creators were Jews and young Jewish males who had been kept out of the, quote, fancier professions because of ethnic discrimination. And they had all wanted to be writers. They had all, so, but in fact, they were all very literate, and they had all been reading Dostoevsky and Kafka. So all that stuff went into the superheroes and came out again in Highsmith's work. So it's very interesting sharing and interpenetration of ideas. The comics vacuumed up everything that was in the zeitgeist. Eventually it would show up in the comics, and then people making films like Orson Welles adored comic books, read them, and comics then began to steal from Welles' films. So it was a fascinating time and very creative and all happening right here in New York City.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of unclear whether Will Eisner's panel layout was inspired by Citizen Kane or vice versa.
That's right. That's right. It's just a really rich historical period. Plus, you have all these marvelous, brilliant people who had refugeed from Europe during the Second World War. All were in New York. Many of them were in Greenwich Village. Here's Highsmith, a precocious 19-year-old version of a club kid who's going to Barnard College, but out every night meeting all these brilliant Europeans here in New York. And so the influences are phenomenal. And you can see them, you can trace them in rivers through her work. And that's why her work is unlike any other Americans, while still being quintessentially American. She's a very interesting creature.
Well, your book is also, you know, unlike most biographies, and so I guess this next sort of non-linear question fits perfectly into the style of your book. But you just mentioned that she was involved in this business that was largely run and produced by Jews, and she mm-hmm. wasn't particularly fond of Jews.
Well, you have to, in order to understand Patricia Highsmith, and it took me a long time to do so, you have to be able to hold two absolutely opposite ideas in your head and two absolutely contradictory feelings in your heart. She hated what she loved. She loved what she hated. Every advance for her also meant a retreat. She was a woman cleft into a gigantic psychological disorder, and she was able to manifest that. She took the best and the worst of herself and put it in her work. And you see that it's no mistake that she ended up at the comics with all the alter egos. It's no mistake that her work explores the great cleaving of identity, and especially American identity. That's what she was like. And so, yes, she was an anti-Semite, and yes, she had a Jew for a biographer. So, things kind of evened out. She also had, but let me just add something,
yes,
so we don't misunderstand her, because she's so complicated. She had many Jewish lovers. Some of her closest friends were Jewish, like they say, and many of her mentors were Jews as well. So, very complicated situation.
Okay, so she's not she's anti-Semitic, and she's not particularly fond of blacks or minorities in general, and yet she was a lesbian and therefore an outsider herself.
Yes, well, that doesn't mean you have to. Look, we are in this era. In our united age now, entirely balkanized. I live mostly in Paris, and when I come back to the United States, what I see is a country of I see 100 countries here of, you know, built on odd ethnic exclusions, and everybody complaining and hating each other, and so I don't think it's that different. Except that they were spared the ethnic identities in mid-20th century. And so, for instance, as a lesbian, who, by the way, was also a misogynist, you know, she railed against women all her life, as well as loving them. As a lesbian, there wasn't that clamp of self-identification necessary in mid-20th century America, she could also sleep with men. And she tried to. And tried to, quote, normalize herself at many times. Never worked for her. So there's a sense that yes, it was a different time, and in some ways, it was a freer time. I think people were more inclined to speak their minds then, and that's why her journals look pretty shocking.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, because you know, a lot of the comic book writers were so ashamed of writing comics because mm-hmm. of the seduction of the innocent and Frederick Wertheim and the sort of the suppression of the comic books, you know, kind of pushed them out of the industry. And there was that whole idea of, you know, not being able to express yourself. There was a lot more censorship in movies and television and so forth.
Well, look, Frederick Wertheim, and I don't want to spend too much time on him,
yeah,
but he was a brilliant psychoanalyst who set up the first clinic for disturbed children in Harlem, whose study of violence was extremely serious. I don't think he actually wanted to ban comics. I know he's the
the villain of
the bugbear of all comics fans, but it's because they haven't looked closely at him. In fact, he was a very astute psychoanalyst. The comics were violent. They have always been violent.
Sure.
Why did I like them so much when I was a kid? Because they were banned, because they were violent, you know, He's not wrong in his analysis. Whether or not you want to go so far as banning something, that's an entirely other question that I have no interest in getting into. But the thing about Highsmith is that she makes you rethink all categories. She offended me on every possible level. It turned out to be a wonderful experience for me. I had to rethink just about everything I know about humans, since just about everything human was alien to her. So I can't tell you how interesting she is and how funny. And when I discovered that the best way to access such an unusual character was by laughter, then I really started having a good time. And I hope you found the book witty. It certainly it seems to have struck people that way. And wit is a very good way to climb the heights of an extreme character. And Highsmith is so extreme that sometimes laughter, you can access her more quickly with laughter than you can any other way.
We're talking with the author of The Talented Miss Highsmith, Joan Shenkar. There's also two Patricia Highsmiths in your book, I think. In the photo section, there's a beautiful picture of her, this nude picture. I don't know if she's 20 years old or something in this picture. And then there's also this sort of hunchbacked older person who doesn't even resemble her.
Well, yes. I often thought that's very smart of you, because when I was writing it, I honestly thought that there should be Volume 1 and Volume 2. Highsmith was an incredibly seductive and beautiful young woman. Men, women, children, everyone fell for her. She had only to walk in a room. I had elderly, distinguished gentlemen tell me with tears in her eyes how beautiful she was, and also lovely ladies of a certain age told me the same story. She struck everyone sensually. Suddenly, around midlife, and we should mention that, like Edgar Allan Poe, and probably for many of the same reasons, she was a huge drinker, an alcoholic. So around midlife, a combination of the alcohol and the ideas that were going through her head began to show up on her face and in her body. And it is as though this pearl of a girl became turned into an embittered old oyster, and you can just see her snapping shut. So it's a very interesting trail to follow.
I want to ask you about a couple more of her novels. You mentioned The Talented Mr. Ripley as being her most famous, but I think Strangers on the Train is also famous because it was also made into the film by Alfred Hitchcock.
That's right. That's the best film, even though, again, Hitchcock didn't quite have I'll have to say the courage to go as far as Highsmith did in his explorations in the film. Strangers on a Train, that began her reputation as a Dostoevskian. It's a brilliant idea. And she had it while walking with her parents, which is very significant since her mother was the great love of her life and also the great hate. Strangers on a Train begins with two men, well, once again, alter egos. Perhaps you'd like to tell the story. Why don't I give it over to you?
Well, they agree on a, well, at least one of them agrees, to murder each other's most hated person so that they would not be, it would be the perfect crime. Why would you be connected with this murder of someone you don't know?
It's a wonderful idea, but it also includes Highsmith's specialty, which is a homoerotic attachment, much suppressed, between two men who are the opposite of each other, but also very like each other. So Bruno, the rich, detestable criminal who proposes this idea to the high-minded young architect, Guy Haines, who has an early marriage that and a troublesome wife whom he would like to get rid of, but is too high-minded to do so. It is Bruno who proposes this. Guy refuses it. Bruno haunts him and wears him down and seduces him. Even in comic book, even in that book, Highsmith is using unconsciously comic book terms. And it's just a terrific book. The fact that Bruno is drowned and Guy is caught in the end, she didn't make that mistake with The Talented Mr. Ripley. Ripley is the one who gets away with it.
And leading, of course, leaving it open for many sequels.
Yes, yes. She wrote five Ripley books. My very favorite is the first, and I think it deserves a nice, fresh plot in the acreage of the great American novel. I believe it is a great American novel, and I think this book is helping it to be recognized as such. There was also, and very important, the second novel she wrote,
The Price of Salt?
The Price of Salt, a beautiful period piece, and practically the only time she really wrote from the point of view of a woman.
Written under a different name, right?
Well, she published it under a different name because it's a love story between two women, and because it's a Highsmithian love story. It's the only novel she published in which no murder takes place, but the murders are all in the metaphors. It's all the lovemaking looks really violent if you take those metaphors apart. That something is always happening that doesn't feel like love, even though it is love. Anyway, it's her only lesbian novel. She was not only ashamed of being a comic book writer, but felt terribly guilty about her sexuality, did not wish to be pigeonholed as a lesbian writer, and so finally agreed to publish it under a pseudonym. And in 1990, now this book was published in 1952, it sold hundreds of thousands of copies. Hmm. When it was republished in England in 1990 by Bloomsbury Press, they persuaded her, she was reluctant to do so, but they persuaded her to use her own name on it, but the title of the book was changed, so to Carol. So somehow, some part of that work is always in disguise.
One more thing about Strangers on a Train that I want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
The film led to the intersection of Patricia Highsmith and Raymond Chandler, and two incredibly great novelists. Did they interact at all?
Not at all. They never met. Highsmith wrote a rather tender and perceptive essay about Chandler after he died, and Chandler was fired from that film. He said, "The plot drove him crazy." And I know why, too. Chandler, whose own signature character, Philip Marlowe, is a high-minded Lancelot type, even though he's the classic noir detective. He really does want to save women. He really does want the world to be good. But such is not the case with Highsmith. And Chandler got fired. I don't know whether it was for drinking or because the plot, as he said, just drove him nuts and he couldn't make sense of it, but Hitchcock fired him.
Well, I've got so many other things to ask you about. We've only just sort of scratched the mm-hmm. tip of the iceberg on your book, and it's called The Talented Miss Highsmith, and it's written by the talented Joan Shankar. And I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll join us again next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank Joan Shankar for being my guest this week. Her new book is called The Talented Miss Highsmith, a biography of Patricia Highsmith, and it's a great work. You should check it out. And you can also check out her acclaimed biography, Truly Wild, a book about Oscar Wilde's niece, Dolly. Also, thanks go to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.